So this talk I'm going to, so this is a tutorial on how to use the Einstein Toolkit, but it starts off with a high-level presentation of what the Einstein Toolkit is. The Einstein Toolkit, like any big software project, it's not just a software project, it's also a community. And if you want to do science at any kind of scale, you usually need a community and some thought about how that works together, because your documentation is never going to be complete. It's never going to be up to date. You need a continuous presence of people who help and give tutorials and so on. So anyway, I'm going to talk about that first and give you a big picture. This talk was cobbled, I'm giving it, but it was cobbled together with pieces of slides from various other presentations. So for me, the Einstein Toolkit story begins 1.3 billion years ago. you all know what I'm talking about, of course. And at this time on Earth, we were in the protozoic eon, and life consists of eukaryotes, including multicellular life forms. So it's very early stages. 540 million years ago, however, we enter the Phanerozoic eon, and we get complex life, including vertebrates. 1 million years ago, we get Neanderthals. 200,000 years ago, we get anatomically modern humans. In 1687, Newton publishes his book talking about Newtonian gravity. In 1905, Einstein publishes his paper on special relativity. In 1914, general relativity. 1916, Schwarzschild publishes the Schwarzschild black hole solution. 1936, Einstein correctly describes gravitational waves. 1956, Felix Pirani eliminates coordinate confusion in describing gravitational waves. Up until then, people were constantly going back and forth on whether they existed. In 1963, Kerr publishes the Kerr black hole solution. That's a rotating black hole. It took 50 years to go from just sitting still to rotating. In 1994, the head-on collision of two black holes was simulated, as well as distorted single black holes. In 1995, distorted Kerr solutions were simulated by me. These were 2D simulations. They were run on a supercomputer at the time. Nowadays, it wouldn't keep your cell phone busy. In 1997, Cactus was created by Joanne and Paul Walker and Joanne Masseau. It remains the basis of one of the best completely open source collaborative frameworks for numerical relativity. While this is not the Einstein Toolkit, this is the basis for it. In 2005, Pretorius published his results on evolving binary black hole spacetimes, where he was able to get multiple orbits to be stable. This was a breakthrough. The Cactus group was like epsilon behind him. They had the evolutions preceding. They just hadn't gotten publication yet. But anyway, up until this time, it was a bunch of people mixing different ingredients together numerically to try to get these black holes spacetime stable. And 2005 was the year it happened. In 2007 to 2009, we started getting the large collaborations for the Einstein for what would become the Einstein Toolkit. And in 2012, the Einstein Toolkit was actually first born. Okay, that started with a paper and a series of, a design for the community and how we would all work together. And then in 2015, of course, LIGO detected gravitational waves, which was where we started with 1.3 billion years ago. So, I mean, having lived through all this, there's just so much drama in that moment. Then we have a quote by David Bowie. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. And then, for your viewing entertainment. All right. So what is the Einstein Toolkit? It's a collection of scientific software components put together to simulate and analyze general relativistic systems. It's freely available at einsteintoolkit.org. It's supported by a bunch of grants, which you don't care what they are, but somebody at NSF, if they ever see these slides, will care to see that all those numbers are there. It's a state-of-the-art set of tools for numerical relativity. It's completely open source. Currently, there are 259 members of the Einstein Toolkit community from 172 different sites in 39 different countries. To become a member, you just go to our member page and say, I want to be a member, and you give your name and your institution. So we're a very inclusive group. The publication list, it says 200 publications as of 2013. I'm sure that number is out of date. We can probably get a better number. There are new publications every year. Apart from the scientific publications, there are also publications based on a spec benchmark made from the Cactus framework. So a lot of people who are just doing computer science are trying to optimize a version of this software. We have regular tested releases, where regular means approximately 6 months. We're due for another release later this month. We have user support through various channels, and that includes our weekly phone calls on Thursday mornings. We have a user's mailing list, which we attempt to answer all your questions on. Generally, we're all quite accessible. So here is the current list of what I would say are the active members of the toolkit. There's me. There's Peter Diener, who works at LSU with me. There's Roland Haas, Helvi Witek, Zach Etienne, Bruno. Yes, thank you. I can't pronounce his last name. And of course, Eric Schnetter. Yeah, I just got to his picture and I thought, I can't say that. Okay, so anyway, these are the people who are currently developing the toolkit, taking it new places, and providing support and other things. So what does it do? So we have science, just a list of the kinds of science that is sometimes done with it. We have binary black hole mergers, neutron star mergers, supernovae, accretion disks, boson stars, hairy black holes, explorations of cosmic censorship, and the like. And it's really not limited to that. I mean, the basic framework, the Cactus framework, has even been used for some coastal simulations. I've used it for what are called Boussinesq water waves. But almost all the infrastructure is focused on general relativity. Any questions so far?
Why did you say Einstein published GR in 1914?
Well, that's what the Wikipedia article claimed.
I thought the paper was what, in 1915.
So, I know, and I saw that, and I thought, well, you know, it's within an error margin of 1 year.
I accept that as an experimentalist.
Yeah, I mean, Maybe what they were saying was that was the day he wrote it. That was when he wrote it, opposed to when he published it. But I looked at that number and I thought 1914 looks wrong, but whatever.
It says 1915, no.
Okay, when I looked, I saw 1914, but it doesn't matter.
Sorry for asking.
No, it's fine. Questions are good. So any code of this nature has to be a community effort. And the infrastructure was designed from the ground up to help people work together. Why? So we have these computational challenges, which if you work in computer simulations, you can probably identify with this particular gorilla. So we started with this. And the way you did problems on this was different from the way you did problems on these devices and on this device. And so the problem is you want to simulate cutting edge science, and you want to use the latest numerical methods, and you want to make use of the latest hardware, whether that's vector, SMP parallelism, scaling to many nodes, adaptive mesh refinement, I mean, these are kinds of things that you want to be able to just use. You don't want to have to sit down and write them all yourself. You don't want to have to figure out everything yourself. I mean, at one point, I guess when I was a grad student, you know, if you wanted to run on a supercomputer, you wrote your Fortran code, you compiled it, the Fortran compiler told you whether your loop vectorized. If it did, you won. And that was it. That was the whole story of optimization. Nowadays, well, this is what you're going to look like if you try to figure it all out. There's too many different things to keep track of, and they're too complex. So you want to be able to make use of a framework in a community that has thought through a lot of these parallelization issues and performance issues. So efficient use of all the hardware is complex and tedious. If you want to, you can't make a reasonable use of the machine if you can't make use of the vector units. You can't make a reasonable use of the machine if you can't scale to all the nodes. You can't make use of good machines these days without GPUs, which Cactus Framework is still lagging on. But in any event, nowadays you require people from different disciplines to help put a code together. You can't just, as a lone wolf graduate student, hope to make sense out of all the optimization that needs to be done yourself. And if you did, you wouldn't get done whatever you were working on your PhD for. You'd get lost in this rabbit hole. So this is just sort of a little digression. Is one of the little things that you have to keep track of that the Cactus Framework does for you. So when you're doing computation on multiple different processors, right, you have sort of fake zones. You have your grid divided up among all the processors, and you have fake zones that mirror what's on other processes. These are called ghost zones. And this allows you to do calculations on one processor, and then the framework has to synchronize these ghost zones periodically between your calculations in order to help make that run. And even doing that by yourself is going to be complicated, right? Even figuring out how to do that simple thing by yourself is going to be a lot of work. And then figuring out what the best way is to chop up your grids and define and divide them among the processors is going to be work, right? And then if you want to do something like this, it's even more, right? So all of these different grid pieces are logically computational boxes. And what we would like, what the Cactus Framework tries to do for you is give you everything in view of a logical box. So you can write your code for a box, and then the framework can apply that box as many times and in as many different ways as it needs to in order to give you the simulation you want. That allows you to spend more of your time working on science and less of your time working on computer science. Unless you're a computer scientist, then you can help us with the infrastructure. Okay? But the idea is the Cactus Framework allows you to divide these things up. So one of the nice things about Cactus, the Cactus code, if you look at it, is how modular it is, how modular the Einstein Toolkit's code is. So if you look at most people's codes when they write simulations for evolution systems, you know, where you start with some initial data and you march forward in time, you will see the time integrator is mixed up into the evolution equation code, right? You will see print statements stuck in the middle there. All of these things are cleanly separated in the Einstein Toolkit, and you can pick and choose them with parameters. So modularization is one of your keys to success in any software venture, and this helps you do it. So here's our slide that we saw before with the puzzled gorilla looking at his or her various issues to deal with. There's vectorization. We have, for vectorization, sometimes the Einstein equations are so complex and so long that compilers don't even try to vectorize them, right? They just give up before they try. And that means you're going to lose an order of magnitude of performance right off the bat because you didn't vectorize. So we have tools, Crank and NerpyPlus, which are symbolic manipulators that generate code. And when they generate code, they can put in the explicit instructions for vectorization. So you can make up on that step. SMP parallelism tends to be achieved by OpenMP, which we didn't write, but we can still use it. Scaling to many nodes at the moment, that's going to require MPI, message passing interface. and carpet is the thorn that has been used primarily to date to achieve that. AMR, adaptive mesh refinement, carpet is the component of the Einstein toolkit, again, that helps you achieve that. But there are GPUs to deal with, and we still haven't gotten those to help us in any efficient way. That may be coming soon with AMRX, which is a new adaptive mesh refinement driver thorn that we're working on. Will we make FPGAs work? Will we make ASICs work? That's custom chips. Imagine you have the Einstein toolkit put on a chip. Neuromorphic processors. So this is another technology that's becoming important, right? Chips that directly mimic neurons, and how can you make use of them? Qubits. It's always been my nightmare that someday someone's going to hand me a board, and it's going to have a CPU, a GPU, an FPGA, an ASIC, a neuromorphic processor, and a quantum chip, and say, make use of that. But look, I mean, the point is, part of the point is that things are getting increasingly complex. The hardware keeps changing. The things that you need to do to get high performance keep changing. And you don't want to get locked into whatever it is, however it is things work now, if possible, right? So these tools are designed to help protect you from that. Even apart from those rather crazy challenges, we have efficient I/O. So Seymour Cray, I think it was asked, what is a supercomputer? And he said, it's a device that takes a computationally bound problem and turn it into an I/O bound problem. So the point is, you can make your code run really fast, right? But if it takes a long time for you to write your data to disk, you still lose. And this is a battle that many codes have to fight with. Getting the data to the disk can actually slow your code down a lot. We re-implemented this WaterWave code that I talked to you about before in the Cactus framework, and the code ran 5 times faster. And the main reason it ran 5 times faster was because this other code was so inefficient at doing I/O that it was just crippled by it. So efficient I/O is one thing that you probably don't want to think about if you are a physicist. HDF5, this is a portable binary format that you probably should be using for your data. It's some amount of pain to set it up and get it working right and to get all your visualization stuff to work with it. But again, this can be solved for you if you just use a framework like Cactus. Checkpoint restart. If you want to run a simulation of any kind at any scale, your code must be able to save its state and restart from that state. Why? Because at large scale now, nodes fail all the time. And you need the ability if that node fails, you need the ability to pick up where you left off and start a new simulation. It's really just not optional anymore. And you don't want to write that yourself. Parameter parsing. OK, this is a minor thing, but you've got to have some kind of file where you set things up. And you know, again, you could do it. You could probably sit there and spend 2 days to a week getting that to work just right. But why should you? Visualization. So yes, you can build visualization software. And Python has a lot of tools that you can work with, for example, today. But it's a complex task. And the less you have to do yourself, always, the better. And so even without all the exotic hardware and all those kinds of performance issues, you don't want to do a framework without those things. You need all those things, but what you want to do, really, is just your tiny little piece, which is called science, and the rest of it you want someone else to do for you. Oh, steering. So maybe you want to adjust the way your code runs as it's running. There are circumstances where this is desirable, and Cactus has some capability for that as well. So collaborative challenges. So part of the concept here is collaboration. We want a way that we can work together, right? So we have a problem that we want to start with. You know, maybe it's simulating black holes, right? And you know, we have a bunch of different groups that want to work on that problem from various places. And they have some resources that they can work on. And so that's the basis of a community. And that community is held together with things like email and phone conversations and chats and websites and a bunch of other collaborative tools that exist today. Okay, so we have Git has taken over the resource, the code management world. But for a long time, it wasn't the ruler. Okay, so we have these problems and we have these groups. And some of them are in competition with one another. So in the Cactus community, in the Einstein Toolkit community, we've devised a system whereby we have this code that's very modular and very pluggable. And it's also very open to the point where you can take that code, you can add your own pieces to it, compute your own results, and publish results, and keep your part secret, right? You don't have to reveal what you're doing until after you get a paper out. And this has been a model that has worked for us. Very often, people will keep their contributions private until they get a paper out, or they will keep their contributions private forever, right? And they will just make use of our infrastructure. Our infrastructure gets cited, science gets enabled, but they are allowed to keep their privacy so that they can do whatever kind of thing they need to do to get their tenure. If you have groups working like this, you need to have standards. And standards are things like toothbrushes. Everyone has them and no one wants to use anyone else's. But there are a few things that as groups you just need to standardize on a few things in order to make progress. HDF5 is one of those great things. So it's a portable binary data format. You need various tools for visualization, for running your code, for other things, right? And you use various languages. We didn't want to tie people to one language or the other when this Einstein Toolkit was first made. So Fortran and C are both supported and they can both be plugged together and Cactus knows about glue to make that work. A lot of the infrastructure is written in Perl. That's because the Einstein Toolkit, Cactus was created in 1997 and what's Python back then? Perl was ruling the world at the time. Nowadays it's Python that rules the world. And I guess if we were writing this today, we would write it in Python rather than C, or rather than Perl. But they both work. The other thing is we want to be able to give credit to everybody who contributes. And the way this has generally worked is we had papers. We had a paper for the Einstein Toolkit, and we had papers for each of the thorns and recommendations for which ones you should cite. We're moving to a new model where we're going to have a DOI, and we're going to public with each release of the software. We're going to have all the names of the people who have worked on the toolkit up to that DOI be on the credit list, so that we can be like LIGO in our list of contributors.
Do you really want to be like LIGO?
So I don't think we want to. Look, if we got that same number of contributors, that would mean we were really successful. On the other hand, it might be a little much. But the point is, if you contribute to the Einstein Toolkit, you can get credit for it. It's not just there was a paper written in 2012. You can never have your name on it because you were never on that paper. The end of the story, right? So that's part of the point. And I think that if you look at people who work at the NSF, that's a model that they're recommending going forward because it makes your software more sustainable, right? People are more likely to work on something if their name can get attached to it. Anyway, so credit can be distributed, and how can we work together? So we've got researchers currently, I guess, in all these different states and all these different countries that are all contributing to the toolkit. And the toolkit was built with the goals of being community-driven, being a core computational for GR, but also being potentially a general-purpose tool. We have components, we have different pieces that kind of go with the Einstein toolkit. We have Cactus, the basic glue that holds everything together. We have a thing called the Sim Factory, which you'll see something about, which helps you build and run Cactus codes. We've got Crank, which is a Mathematica tool for generating code. We've got NERPI Plus, which is a Python tool for generating code. This is the NERPI symbol here. And then we've got our long list of science modules. Guiding principles are we're open, community-driven. We try to have good interfaces and separation of physics from computational concerns. And we use code reviews and other procedures to get components in and to keep them of high quality. So initially, we have some infrastructure and application code. And then over time, it sort of grew, right? So we got these puzzle pieces. We have some base modules. So this is what we're trying to solve. And we have the curvature. We have some constants. We have matter, hydrodynamics, electromagnetism, particle radiation. And so this gets broken up into thorns, right? And this is just a really small sampling of the thorns that we have in the toolkit and what they do, right? So we have these are sort of the highest level matter evolution thorns, and these are the highest level space-time evolution thorns. But these things are in principle separable, so you can mix and match them. I think this is a repetition that I didn't notice. But anyway, this is another restating of our guiding principles. In our citations, we have no requirement to cite anything. We don't require it, but we do ask. And we have a list of recommended publications. In the future, we will have we hope to have a new driver thorn. It's part of the reason I'm here, is to help work on this, called AMRX. And it will be like carpet in its basic function, but the basic infrastructure for the AMR is DOE funded. So we will essentially have people who are maintaining the core of that for us. We're gonna have a new declarative syntax in the code to make it easier to keep your grid variable, your grid functions synchronized. There is a new spherical coordinates thorn coming from RIT, which is a very important thing for people who are doing neutron stars. And the NERPI Plus tool is still very much under development and is rather new. This is a list of some of the thorns we've had recently for looking at alternatives to general relativity and looking at some new ways of doing hydrodynamics. You should look at the EinsteinToolkit.org website. It's cool. it runs out of a Docker container. It's open source. The toolkit and the website and everything are open source and enable high-end research. Okay, so this is my, and I think there's like a wrap-up. No, that's the last slide. Okay, so are there any questions about the Einstein toolkit, what it is, what it does, why you should want to use it? Yes?
You have a flow chart of all these thorns, so which one is for which, just as you showed before in the documentation website.
Uh-huh, but it's better than mine?
Well, I cannot find it.
Oh, all right, yeah.
That'd be good if you can find it.
Yeah, no, we should. So one of the things that had occurred to me when I was, last time I gave a talk about the Einstein toolkit, is we should even have a standard talk that was just sitting in a repository that we can just pull out whenever we need it. And having a bigger flowchart would be one of the things that I think would be good to have, but I don't know of one.
So we have the paper from a few years ago that describes designs, capabilities, and lists the name of the important thorns.
But does it have a picture like that?
No.
Yeah, so the picture is kind of what, you know, seeing how they fit together, just not just the list would be nice, I think. Okay, so you don't need to see that. All right, so are we ready to get our hands a little dirty?
Yeah. Yes.
All right, so Shoot, that was the slide I wanted. Okay, so this is how you're going to set up for this tutorial. You go to this link. There's no software to install on your computer. We're going to do everything through a Jupyter notebook, if you're familiar with that. So go to this link. There's a place on, you will create for yourself on the page that you arrive at, you will create for yourself a login. In order to create that login, you need this code, okay? So rather than handing out logins to everybody, you get to decide what your username is and what your password is, and nobody will have to share with anyone else.
Illegal character and password.
What's that?
Illegal character and password.
Yes, there are. You need to keep away from those less thans and greater thans and whatever else you tried to put in there. And then once you get yourself logged in, this is the name of the notebook that we're going to be using. So you'll click on that. So I'm going to just give you a few minutes to get set up with that. And if you have any questions, raise your hand. And if you succeed, you could also just raise your hand and just let me know.
How much for the password?
I don't remember the limits I put on there, but if you put 8 to 10 characters, you're probably good. You know, if you try to make your password the letter A, it's not going to take it. If you try to make your password, it won't like that either.
I mean,
you say friend.
The notebook.
I'm sorry, did somebody have a question?
No, I said I am in the notebook.
Oh, great. Anybody else got the notebook open? Anybody having trouble? Anybody not have it open yet? Okay, I'll give you just a minute more.
Yes.
Okay, great. So, you know, before we invented this system, the part that we just did took about a half an hour. All right, so let me log out. Log in. Okay, so the concept of how many people are not familiar with Jupyter notebooks? Not familiar with? Very few. Okay, so I guess I can go over this lightly. But Jupyter notebooks are a way of keeping your computational results and your code together in one place. You can have your documentation, your visualization, your executable code, everything, all in one place.
Steve, can you write the code on the blackboard?
I can. ETK Pi 2019. Okay. That's
okay. Yeah, I wrote it down here. Sorry.
Yeah, I just thought it might be nicer to have it a little larger. There. All right.
Very good. Thank you.
Connection failed. What? Okay, so there's a lot of text in here, which I'm not going to read. A lot of it's going to tell you things that you need to do to set up Cactus if you're installing it on your laptop or whatever. This is some setup that we use just to make things work right. So by and large, this notebook is based on the Python language, okay? And frequently we have to escape from the Python language to bash and run just like a bash command. So we have this to help us do that in a nice way. Also, for whatever reason, by default, Python notebooks, when they show you the output, they don't, and the output is large, they don't keep it locked to the bottom. they keep it at the top, and you have to keep manually scrolling it down. So we've got this little thing here, which will help you with that. And then we've got these two environment variables, our guidance to MPI, so that without which, if we all run a two-processor simulation, everyone in the room will run on the same two cores without those two things. So anyway, you need to execute that cell. And to do that, you first click on it, and then you hit Shift Enter. Okay, and then what will happen is that little box up next to the N will be a star while it's running, and it will turn into a number once the cell executes. And in my case, it didn't execute, so I'm going to do it again. Once in a while, that happens. Okay, so you should see a number inside that box. Okay? Now,
my number is 1. Why is your number 2?
Because when I ran it the first time, it did work. Oh. It just didn't update the box. So I ran that same cell twice. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to cd into our home directories. And then we're going to run this curl command. Curl will download a script, a curl script called getComponents. And getComponents is the thing that downloads and assembles the Einstein Toolkit. So part of the concept of the Einstein Toolkit is it's not centralized, right? We do have, we don't have one repo with all the code in it. We have repos all around the world because different researchers in different places want to have control of their own piece of it. And so getComponents is going to check out all those different pieces and put them together. So now what we're going to do is we're going to check out the toolkit itself. So we're going to use getComponents to check out the toolkit. We're not downloading the full Einstein toolkit for this course, for this tutorial, because it takes a while to compile, and we just thought we'd save a little time. So we've got a truncated list of components that you can download this way. If you want the full list, you can use this commented out code here. And I guess in my case, I already had it checked out. So in my case, it finished almost instantly. But in your case, you should see it downloading things. So let me, while yours is downloading, so what you can do with your notebooks, right, is you can insert code, right? And what I can do is I can say bang cat, and then I can say Einstein toolkit underscore 09209.th. Whoops. I didn't get the dot in. You can put this code in, and then you can run it. And then you get to see what this file that you downloaded looks like. So on the inside, what it shows you is a bunch of different repositories, right? It shows you a bunch of different repositories. And it shows you what components come from those repositories. In principle, right, if you write your own module for the Einstein Toolkit, you can make something that looks similar to this that will download your code. You can create a thorn list. You can pass it to your fellow students or whatever. And you can compile, check out, compile, and run with that. We're not going to talk about the details of what's in there, but I think it's kind of nice to see. How many people have succeeded in downloading? Okay, good. Almost everybody.
So if you have trouble, I can walk between the aisles and help you, even if you don't want to stop, Steve. Speak
up. Yeah, if you have any difficulties, raise your hand. Okay, we got one in the back of the room. Okay, so now we're going to change directory, and we're going to go into the cactus directory. That's where everything is checked out. Just a little, let me just take another little detour here and insert another cell. Bang ls. Okay, so in this directory, we see this source directory, which is where most of the flesh is. We've got an executable. That's where our cactus executable is going to go. We've got arrangements. That's where all the science thorns are going to go. So it's got this basic structure to it, and it's all held together by this make file. Any questions? Yes.
Do I need to have all those files?
No, you shouldn't have all those files. Mine's already built. Yours is going to be a little smaller. OK, so now we're going to configure and build. Now, SimFactory needs to do some setup first. It has to figure out some things about your local machine. So you just run this command, and it comes up with, you know, who you are and what your machine is and so on. And it creates this local definitions file for you. I'm pointing with my finger, but I've got a hockey stick here. OK. And then what we're going to do is we're going to build the Einstein toolkit. And this is the command that does it. So we're going to use the SimFactory, right? We're going to say SimFactory bin sim build. And then we're going to tell it to make in parallel. So what this is doing, right, this is telling you how to invoke the make command. And this is telling you invoke the make command with minus J3 to run in parallel three ways. I think the machine can handle it. We'll see.
I think there's a more modern way to do that.
There is, but I like this one because if you see this, you realize any command that you want to pass through to make, you can just put in there. So if you want to say, you know, verbose equal yes in there, and you want to see the verbose output of your make command, you can get it that way.
So for me, it says make minus J1 instead of J3.
Oh, really? I thought I updated everybody's to three. Well, you can change it. You can edit it if you want.
Is it necessary?
It is not necessary. It just will build, in principle, it should build faster with more processors. The machine has 40 cores, 80 with hyperthreads if you count that way. I think we'll be OK if everybody builds with two. Probably two would be better, given how many people there are.
I started doing it with J1.
It'll take you longer.
I'm also using J1. I started too early as well.
All right. So if you want to, you can hit kernel and then interrupt and then rerun the cell. And it will edit the number and rerun the cell. And it will do the rest of it with a different number of processors. So mine is already built. And it looks something like that. OK, so.
I notice you have the thorn local reduce in there. I don't think you're using it, and it takes a long time to compile.
OK.
Might be able to take it out.
I'm just
confusing you because.
No, no. Look, I am sure this can be optimized more than it was, right? It was sort of done ad hoc by hand. And I think it's probably useful to go through and do a more systematic version. I am allergic to Canada. I am allergic to chalk dust.
Oh, wow.
The only way you can make it more difficult for me is you could bring some cats in.
Cats slept on my laptop.
Yeah. That probably won't transfer too much, Sandra.
There were several warnings. Should I?
So there will be warnings. Don't worry about that. Warnings are inevitable in a large software project when they compile, right? Because what happens is you create this huge code base, hundreds of thousands of lines, you're adding things. And guess what? The compiler people are updating too. And they decide, hey, you know, this frequently causes trouble. We're going to put in a warning for that. And then suddenly, your 100,000 lines of code, you're getting warnings all over the place. And you try to shut some of them off, and some of them are useful, but it's a losing battle, right? So. And not only that, but some people develop, sometimes you develop on one compiler, and then you go and you use another one, right? You develop on, say, Intel, and then somebody goes to run it on GCC, and you discover some new warning or possibly even error. So you're going to see warnings. That's just inevitable. And yes, we do make efforts to clean them up at times, but usually it's, you know how it is when you're working on software. What is biting me hardest right now? What is causing me the most pain? Is it that warning message that flies by when people build? Probably not. And you know, it's often things like unused variable. Okay, so I didn't use a variable. I'm using up a whole int of, I'm wasting a whole int of storage space. I mean, you know. So just a bit about more about Jupyter Notebooks. They're kind of a really nice thing in many ways, in case you're not familiar with them or not deeply familiar with them. And that is, they, you know, there's often this war between the code, you know, the command line people and the GUI people. And it's just sort of a middle place, right? You've got sort of the best of both worlds. You've got your code plus your results and everything all in one place. It's also nice for doing tutorials, right? If you want to do a tutorial, we used to do tutorials where people tried to install on their laptops. And then a bunch of people brought in, you know, Windows 95 on their laptop with 1 gig of memory. And then you say, you know, and it just wouldn't work there. And we tried putting little virtual machines on sticks. Oh, well, my computer doesn't have a USB reader. My computer doesn't have a CD-ROM. And it's just endless headaches. And then even once you get it set up, you know, different version of the virtual machine, virtual box or whatever, and you were always looking at a 45-minute setup. And then at the end of the day, there'd just be some number of people who just couldn't do it. So if you're doing any kind of tutorial, Jupyter Notebooks simplify this whole process. You just have a web page. You don't have to install anything. You don't have to worry about the limitations of people's computers. So long as they can connect to the internet, you should be okay. How many people have succeeded?
On the browser? Are there any requirements on the browser you use?
There aren't many. For some few small things that happen, sometimes Safari gives us trouble, but not always. Usually, so there's this feature of the notebooks where you can open a terminal, and Safari tends to have trouble with that. But we don't really use that feature. So to answer your question, it's very rare that we have any trouble with that.
That's good.
Are we installing it in our books?
No, you're installing it on a machine in LSU. A week or so from now, I'll delete everything you did. Okay, this is just temporary for you to learn with. How many people have finished building? Anyone? No, still too early for that, I guess. So the Einstein Toolkit is a substantial piece of code, and it takes quite a while to build. So let's see, what more can I tell you while it's building? Somehow or other, I think I have more to say at this point than I seem to have right now.
In LIGO, we have some machines in our clusters where if you log in there, then everything is installed already.
Right, so you can set up an SSH environment, right? And the difficulty that you have with that, at least in my experience, first of all, there's this process of distributing the accounts. And then you tell people, no two people should use the same account. And I have found that it's almost impossible to get people to obey that. I don't know why. I start out and I emphasize, you absolutely must not use the same account, and people do it. You know, this way, so, well, okay, so the other thing, we didn't usually give unique passwords. We had one password, so we didn't have to hand out paper. But then people would just pick a number and not tell us they did it and overlap with people. Anyway, there's some setup involved with that. And you might not have SSH on your machine. And then there's that hassle, right? Everybody has a web browser.
So we are not actually logging in in the LSU machine.
You are. When you log in, you're logging into the LSU machine and running everything through that. This is, as I said, it's a 40-core machine somewhere at CCC.
But we're not doing it through SSH.
You are not doing it through SSH. You're doing it through the browser.
Somehow I thought that the browser was doing the SSH first.
It might be. It's probably using SSH protocol underneath at some level, especially if I do, if I go here and scroll up. There you go. If I go and do something like this. You know, even then, it probably isn't. So this is going to give me a terminal. No, in fact, I know it isn't, because I've had the experience where I messed up my SSH, and I had this web server still running, and I used that to get back into my computer. Why is this so slow?
Because 25 people are doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's part of it, I guess. What's that?
Maybe EduRome is not behaving.
It's possible that EduRome is slow. I've noticed lags on a number of things I've done today. When somebody succeeds in finishing their build, oh wow, okay, almost everybody. Who's still waiting? Okay, maybe half the people have finished.
The ones who finished, did you use J3?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. I interrupted
mine. Ah, you started. Okay, so it should end like pretty soon.
Yeah, so the other thing is, right, as people finish, right, there's more compute resources available, and the ones that are left should go faster.
I'm done.
Good. All right. Who's still waiting? All right. So so the next thing we're going to do is we're going to try to actually run Cactus, okay? And I think that I'm just going to start talking about this and running through this. And I think that the people who are still compiling will catch up shortly. And if at any time anyone has a question or something is not working, please raise your hand or scream in pain or something. All right. So we're going to use our SimFactory code again to run this. Now, SimFactory doesn't let you run a simulation with the same name twice. And if you're doing tutorials and repeating things, that's somewhat awkward. If you're trying to do real science and you don't want to actually step on your simulation results, it's a good thing. But in here, I'm just going to go ahead and delete that, ask the computer to make sure that that simulation is not there before I start, because it's hello world. It's not like I'm going to lose 100 hours of science if this gets squashed. So I'm going to run this with SimFactory, and it's going to do a create run. So it's just going to run this interactively, which is something you should never, ever do on a cluster, right?
Thank you.
If you do create run on a cluster, what you're doing is you're running on the head node, and you're taking resources away from everybody else without going through the scheduler. And that's not nice. OK? Anyway, when you run your code, you should see something that looks like this. And for some reason, my scroll down seems to not be working. I don't know why. And you should see somewhere in your output, you should see hello world written a bunch of times. That means you succeeded. So you ran a thorn called hello world. And all it does is print this message out.
Oh, so many times?
I think it's doing it based on the number of cores it thinks it has. Anybody have any questions? How many people are still compiling? It seems like there's more now than there were before. That shouldn't be. All right, I'm going to wait just a few more minutes before I go further.
Yeah, we have it.
I'm going to rerun. I'm going to rerun my scroll down tool. just because I'm not seeing the scroll down. Importing it twice shouldn't hurt anything. So Bruno is not going to do this part. I am, but I should have taken that text out of there. Yes.
So when you actually ran that, there are these warnings about numprocs,
yes,
transfer processors.
Pay no attention to that.
How do you come up with those numbers when you're running on a big CPU? Because like in the past, I've had to experiment quite a bit to get the performance out of the machine.
Look, there's nobody who's gonna completely eliminate the need for experimenting to get good performance out of the machine. We can't do that yet. Maybe someday with AI magic stuff we'll do it. I don't know. no, seriously, Cactus can solve a lot of problems for you, but you're, at the end of the day, you're still gonna, when you go to a new machine, you're gonna have to experiment. We try to make it easier for you, and you have the capability of passing on instructions to other students. Like, there's a question of whether, if you've got 16 cores, do you run 4 MPI processes with two OpenMP threads each, and so on. You know, what's the right balance? This is just going to require some experimentation. It may even depend on the problem you run. Another question. Okay. Who's still compiling? One less person at least. Okay, so the next thing that we're going to look at is we're going to look at a neutron star, and we're going to look at what the space-time does. And this is just going to redo some of the basic setup here, because sometimes when we have done this tutorial, there's been a break in between this first part and this part, and we just want to make sure everything is working back the way it was. So we run those two cells, and that just gets everything set up again. Just going to pause a few more minutes while people compile. You're all running with J3?
J1.
What?
J1.
You're running with J1. Who's running with J1? Okay, you guys are just going to take a while.
I'm running J2.
You know what you could do is you could, since there's so few people here at this point, you could just interrupt it and compile with J5, and you should be okay. Just accelerate yourself. So you go to kernel, interrupt, and then edit that J1 to be a J5, and then do it. And you'll be done in no time. Now, the number of processes you use to build something is kind of critical, because if you use too many and your machine doesn't have enough memory, GCC will die on you, right? You'll get an error from GCC and it will fail. So you have to be a little bit careful when you compile on your laptops. But Melody05, which is the name of the machine that's running this tutorial, is quite beefy. I don't think you can kill it. Yes, it's not a challenge. All right, so for this TOV star, we're going to remove the simulation just as we did before. And then we're going to look at this parameter file. Now, there's too much for me to tell you about in here, but I'm going to go through some of the information. So in a parameter file, what you do is you start off with, it doesn't have to be in this order, but typically it starts off with a declaration of which thorns are active, which modules that you're using. And Cactus will dynamically load them and put them together. So this is going to be based on Carpet. It's going to use the method of lines for time integration. It's going to use Carpet Regrid, and it's going to use this IOHDF5 module. It's going to use TMU New Base and Hydro Base, and It's got special thorns for handling boundary conditions and the coordinates themselves. And it does, they don't all have to be here. We can sprinkle some of them down through the code. Cactus also provides you with a number of different ways that you can decide when to terminate your code. So you can terminate based on simulation time or wall time or number of iterations. Wall time is useful if you're running on a queue on a supercomputer, because if you exceed your wall time, the supercomputer will kill your job. They will just, whatever, and whatever thing you've got going on at that time will be lost, right? So ideally, if you set it for, you set that time to end based on wall clock, then you know you can get a save done right before you get killed. There are other things. So you can also do your wall time termination with a termination trigger. You can say this thing shouldn't run for more than 24 hours of wall time. And you can tell it other things on termination times. Here we can set up the grid, and I think a fairly straightforward way. We say what our xmin, ymin, xmax, ymax, all these things. And then we say what dx, dy, and dz are in each of those dimensions. So that defines our base grid. There are some things for carpet regrid about number of centers and so on. This is for mesh refinement, and we're not really going to do anything with that here. We're going to use symmetries. We're going to have reflection symmetries. So you have your star, and it's the same in two different planes. So we're not going to evolve both of them since they're identical. We're just going to use reflection to get that symmetry. We specify the number of time levels, the spatial order that we're using for derivatives and the like. Poisson new time levels. This is something to help you with your debugging. You get not a number or NaN written into various time levels with this in place. ODE methods. So we're going to use Runge Kutta 4 to evaluate this. There are a number of other time stepping schemes that you can pick. And as I said, the time stepping scheme is decoupled from your actual science code. We're checking for NANs rather infrequently. We're going to use GR Hydro. We have GR Hydro Thorn brought in. And we give it its various parameters, right? MLBSSN, this is the space-time evolution method, and we give that some parameters for the various, you know, things we need for that to work right. Dissipation, so typically in AMR simulations, you need some level of dissipation to handle problems with grid boundaries, and there are things that you can set, you know, these are the variables you want that to apply to with these parameters. So as you can see, these parameter files get to be quite complicated and quite long all by themselves. And normally, people don't write them from scratch, right? Normally, what you do, Cactus has a bunch of different parameter files that do a bunch of different things as part of its code base. And normally, what you'll do is you'll take one of those and you'll edit it. You say, I'll take this TOV star and I'll add something to it. I'll take this black hole collision, I'll add something to it. Has everybody finished compiling? Okay. So what we're going to do, we're going to write this file out. So at the top of this file is a %% write file, right? This is what's called a magic. It's just like the thing we use for Bash. It's going to write the file to this file name. Everything that comes below it is going to be written there, so that you can use your Jupyter notebook as kind of like an editor, right? By doing this, you can just edit what's in here and save it to whatever file you want. So let's run that. Okay, and then we're going to submit the job to SimFactory. Now, this time we're doing it a little differently, in case you hadn't noticed. So instead of create run, we have create submit. So what this is going to do is, if you're running on your laptop, that will put the job into the background. If you're running on the supercomputer, it will put it into the batch queue system. Now, SimFactory knows about the batch queue systems of a lot of big machines, so you might not have to configure anything. It might just set it up for you. If it hasn't, then you have to figure out how to tell it to do that, and then you probably need help from us. Okay, so it's now running in the background somewhere. And what I can do is I can ask SimFactory, you know, how is my job doing? I can say list simulations TOVET, and oh, connecting to kernel, that's not good. Anybody else have that problem?
No.
So what you should see, you should just see that job is running.
That's what it says.
And if you go to the next cell and run it, you should see the output of that job. I think mine is dead. I'm gonna do that. And I'm gonna go up here. Give me just a minute. I don't know why mine died, but what?
Wireless? Do you want to plug in your cable? There should be a network cable there.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Adapter. Okay. Well, there goes that idea.
Let me try one more time here. Restart kernel. Okay, well, I'm not gonna worry about mine. Mine isn't important. And I don't know why mine is suddenly unable to do anything. But what you should be able to do, right? So you're doing,
how long does it run? Runs for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or so?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. So I'm about a third done with my simulation. I guess the others in the audience might be similar.
Yes. Anyway, so what's going to happen is when you run this follow command, okay, this is never going to terminate, right? This cell is never going to terminate on its own. It's just going to it's essentially running a tail minus f on the output of the file. So you're going to have to use kernel interrupt to stop it. At some point, you will do that. And then you will come over here, and you will list simulations, and that should show your TOV star simulation as finished. Let me know if you get to that. Has anybody gotten there? One person?
Two.
Two?
Have we gotten what?
Three? Have you finished? Has your simulation finished?
Oh, no.
No.
Not yet. No.
So I think it runs until 400, and I'm at 170 now.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm at 150.
I should have had a glass of water up here.
I can fetch you one.
It would be appreciated.
I have a question. Does the code use finite differences? Or?
Yes. Cactus is using finite differences.
What order?
Well, you can specify it, but I think this simulation is using fourth order.
In the interior or like everywhere?
Everywhere, I believe.
Okay.
I think that for high-end black hole simulations, you want to use eighth order, typically. And this is one of the reasons why people have been trying to go to some other numerical methods.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is, okay, so now you need eighth order, right? And then you need a matching time integrator,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you have this problem when you're doing adaptive mesh refinement, you can't, you need n times extra sets of those ghost zones, because so-called buffer zones, because you can't just get data from outside and bring it in. So you have to get all this data, and suddenly you've got far more ghost zones than you have actual computation zones. So this is just one of the many kinds of struggles you deal with any code. A more modern method for dealing with this is discontinuous Galerkin, because then you only need the one zone, and you don't have a lot of these same issues. But that's still a bit experimental. And there are also, independently, there are techniques for getting rid of the buffer zones. But you can use Adam's fast forth integrators and so on.
So you know it's finished when it begins repeating the end?
No, it should at the end, at the very end, it should just sort of stop. The output should be no new output. It should just sort of stop.
Or if you run again the last command, you should get finished, right?
Yeah, if you run that, and after that, if you run this command, you should see finished. Thank you. Yep. Yeah, Pepsi syndrome. All right. How are you doing on your simulation, Eric?
270 out of 400. Close to 400, right?
I think so.
Another 10 minutes.
So, Cactus has, we're getting close to the end. We just have a couple of different little things to show you. Cactus has got has got integration with Visit, right? So you can use Visit to visualize your output results. It understands carpets. But sometimes, you know, that's more power than you need. And one of the nice things about notebooks is Python lets you plot inside the notebook. So we're going to let you do that. Typically, in order to enable that, you need to have the magic matplotlib inline in there, and then you import matplotlib, and you can do all your plotting inside. Yes?
So you can actually plot simulation output while the simulation is still running. You don't need to stop it. Of course, you just see the result until wherever the simulation is, but you can just stop the follow command, and then continue in the notebook, and then as you plot, the plot grows slowly as the simulation continues running.
Yeah, if you keep rerunning the plot commands. So, you also have commands in SimFactory to get the output directory that you, in case this is a remote machine, and it's put it in some weird place, SimFactory will know about that. Okay. If you have used, who has used NumPy before? Who has not used NumPy? Like one person. So NumPy is really a great tool. It's one of the things that really makes Python worthwhile. And one of the built-in routines in Python in NumPy is gen_from_txt. And gen_from_txt is able to read in ASCII data that's sort of formatted as a table, and it's able to do it very fast. And it provides you with a data structure that is actually based on C instead of Python. And so when you operate on it, it's also very fast. And so we're going to use that to read in the data from an output file called hydrobase-row.maximum.asc. And then you can, this is some commands that you can give matplotlib to set up things like what you want, how you want to label the x and the y, and whether you want a legend to appear on your graph. It's not really necessary. The next couple of commands are probably excessively fancy things to take a simulation result and store it as a string. and then read it back from a string. Yes, Roland put it in there. And one of the reasons that it's kind of nice to have is it provides you, if you've got this string, you can compare the plot that's in there with your results, and it should look exactly the same. But the details of that are probably not something you care about. Unless, you know, you really like noodling around with Python.
See a plot.
And hopefully it's a bunch of lines exactly overlaying each other. Like three or four lines.
It looks like a central density plot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a central density plot. Yeah. But there should be like, it should have, on the legend, there should be like two or three different colors. No? Just one?
The first plot has one color. It's another plot further
down. Oh, okay. Yes, sorry. Yeah. The next plot further down should have three, and they should all line up. That just says everything worked as expected.
Oh, yep.
Yeah.
And then once you have your plots, we're done with the tutorial. So,
it's nice that you can plot it even if it's not finished.
Yeah.
It's almost finished, though.
Just because simulations run for 3 weeks.
Yeah, mine is finished. Thank you.
And if
you
go so,
it's done every
5 minutes,
and we'll never finish.
So if you go to follow up with this, there are other tutorial notebooks that we have that teach you how to write thorns, to program for cactus, and some other things that we're working on. So if you want to continue beyond what we've covered here today, you can go to those locations to find more. Yes?
Will the materials be still available after?
At some point I will delete them, but I'll probably leave this up at least for a week. I said that last time I gave the tutorial, and I think it was 3 months, but
we can do it some other point, maybe next week. I can help you run on Symmetry, our HPC system, and you can also take whatever you have stored there and copy it over to Symmetry, and then if you lose that account, you can continue to use it here.
Also, if you just email me and say, hey, I really want to keep this another week, I'm not going to kill you.
So this simulation helps us if you can get some tangible results within a few minutes of running something. But that might be a bit optimistic. If you want to do some actual science, getting black holes, waveforms or something, then the time scale is probably days or weeks of getting something. And if you write your own parameter file, you probably have multiple false starts before something comes out. But that can be quite frustrating. I'm sorry about that. So but you can ask on the mailing list, ask me or something, to give you a leg up to get you started.
Yeah,
famous example parameter file for two black holes. GW, you must know the number, the first one.
GW 15.
Oh, 15.
It was in my slides.
Yes, so we have a parameter file for that. That probably won't run on your laptop, but maybe one or two nodes in a supercomputer, and you can run that. And it probably runs for a day or two, and you can some waveforms.
So you can change the masses in there?
Yeah, you can change.
Yes, you can. But if you change them extremely, right? If you change them to 10 to 1, then you need to update other parts of the parameter.
Yeah, that's not going to work out so well.
And you on a circular orbit, if you change the masses, you're probably going to end up on an eccentric orbit because getting the eccentricity out requires careful tuning of the initial moment.
So was it so fast because like the amount of points we had on the grid was like really tiny?
Yes, it was carefully engineered in terms of resolution and time to fit within a tutorial.
So is the result like correct or is total garbage?
It's kind of correct.
It's kind of correct.
Okay, you're simulating a Neutron-Stein equilibrium and you see wiggles there.
Okay, makes sense. Oh, but they're not very big wiggles.
I mean,
it's like 2% or something. You'd hope for something better.
Okay. For something that fits inside a tutorial. I think it's
yeah.
I think it's wonderful.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you.
This is a very nice tutorial.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
And also for the development, I mean, it's very hard to know which one is doing which in the Einstein toolkit.
What do you mean, which one was doing which?
Suppose, let's say, I want to modify the TOB equation.
You want to modify what?
I want to modify TOB equation to
uh-huh.
kind of other, let's say, here. So.
Well, you'd find the relevant thorn for the TOV initial data, right? And then you would modify that, which I guess is Omni, one of those thorns. Where is my? It's probably commented in here. But you would start with that, and then you might look through the source code, and if you couldn't figure that out, you'd email us.
Okay.
But you can probably figure it out from the PAR file.
Suppose, let's say, I want to add in an extra type of material, let's say dark matter, into it.
Yeah. So TOV solver, that's probably the one that's doing your initial data. And that's probably the thing you would try to modify.
I suppose I want to add in dark matter, which is not acting gravitationally. So then you need to feed in this data to the Poisson solver, right? Or
yes, you would. And look, that's going to be some work to figure out. However, the plan will be that we're going to integrate this with NERPI. NERPI Plus. And at that point, what you'll have in NERPI Plus, if everything goes the way we anticipate, right, you'll have your initial data for your elliptic solver, and you'll have your update equations in sort of equation form. And you'll be able to update those and change this. Okay, but that's the future. Right now, you're stuck with editing either the Fortran or C++ code and hunting through it like you normally would. But this is, I think, having symbolic manipulators and generating code is an important step forward that I think, you know, all major frameworks should take, because it really helps you isolate, it helps you modularize more between the computer science and the physics. Any other questions? All right, well, I'll be hanging around here to watch you finish your simulations or whatever else you want to do. But that's the end.
Thank you.
Thank you.